This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today, a discussion about the Magna Carta. If you're having trouble remembering exactly what that is, that's okay. You're probably not alone. You might have read about it last in high school history class. It's one of the most famous documents in the world, and it was written almost exactly 800 years ago. As a refresher, here's a bit of an animated explanation of the Magna Carta by Monty Python's Terry Jones for the British Library.
Let us take you back to medieval England. It's the year 1215, and the ruler is King John. Many people believe that King John was one of the worst kings in history. He imprisoned his former wife, he starved his opponents to death, he allegedly murdered his own nephew, and pulled the beards of the Irish chiefs. King John had imposed heavy taxes on his barons in order to pay for his expensive foreign wars. If they refused to pay, he punished them severely or seized their property. The barons demanded that King John obey the law. When he refused, they captured London and John was forced to negotiate. The two sides met at Runnymede in June 1215. The result of the negotiations was written down by the king's clerks into the document we know as Magna Carta. Although most of the charter's clauses dealt with medieval rights and customs, Magna Carta has become a powerful symbol of liberty around the world. The most famous clause, which is still part of the law today, for the first time gave all free men the right to justice and a fair trial. No man shall be arrested or imprisoned except by the judgment of their equals and by the law of the land. To no one will we sell. However, this clause was not as liberal as it sounds. The charter only applied to free men. The vast majority of people in 1215 were unfree peasants who were ruled over by their landowners. And although Magna Carta was intended to create peace between King John and his rebellious barons, England was plunged into civil war after the Pope declared the charter invalid. When King John died of dysentery in 1216, 9-year-old Henry III took to the throne. To keep the peace, Magna Carta was reissued several times during the 13th century, until it was finally made part of English law.
The Magna Carta, in some form or another, is still with us today. It's echoed in the United States Declaration of Independence and in the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Many of the ideas behind habeas corpus and the right to a trial by a jury of one's peers stem from the Magna Carta, at least in spirit. Many believe the document's most important legacy is that everyone, including our leaders, must obey the law. Today on the program, a panel of local Utah legal experts discuss the ongoing significance of the 800-year-old document and how its value still influences judicial practices and law enforcement in the United States today. On the panel today, Judge James Blanche is a judge with the 3rd District Court, appointed in 2012 by Governor Gary Herbert. Professor Michael Teeter is an associate professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Russell Ferrix is a lawyer and an ACLU of Utah board member. And Justice Dino Jimenez is a recently appointed justice on the Utah Supreme Court and serves as the moderator today. This forum was recorded at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah on April 22nd.
You know, we're here celebrating the Magna Carta because it was allegedly, I'd say, on June 15th, when it was signed at Runnymede by King John and the barons and nobles with whom John just could not get along. It had, as the Chief Justice has put it, a particularly ignoble birth. Nobody on either side of the signing is worthy of a lot of meritorious distinction, I would say. They were both looking to butter their own bread, frankly. And Ferrix is right that shortly afterwards, I think within a matter of 2 to 3 months, it was quickly discarded. But it is important, at least historically and from my perspective, in that it is the first time of which I am aware, and I'll leave it to the panel members to correct me if I'm wrong, in England, from which we gather so much of our jurisprudence, that the king subjected himself to the laws of the land. And it has certainly become symbolic and an important source. It kind of transmogrified and was, you know, reinvented, if you will, over the years. But it certainly became an important symbol and from which we drew a lot of the inspiration for our Constitution, well, our Declaration of Independence. So,
yeah,
Russ?
I think that's fair context, that somehow we seem like we are always in search of the totem, the original document that binds us all in some kind of ecclesiastical way. Whether it's the Ten Commandments that were written on tablets of stone or golden tablets or some origin in spirituality, we're always looking for the source, as though somehow once we find the source, then you've answered all the questions and the uncertainty. And I think that Judge Blanche's point about the jury trial is very interesting. We may say that it originates in the Magna Carta, but it doesn't. The Magna Carta doesn't use the term jury trial. So you have to impute that backwards into what they were trying to do at the time. And it only dealt with free men. And free men were the noble folks, the barons at the time. So this didn't apply to very many people. Certainly didn't apply to women. Didn't apply to serfs, folks who didn't own any land. It didn't even apply sometimes to the knights, the folks that were hired to go and fight the wars for the king. So it was a fairly limited trial by peers. And so sometimes we have to kind of impute these things backwards and realize that that's actually what we're doing. We're not drawing meaning forward into our current time so much as imputing meaning backwards into a document that we can recognize as as an acceptable totem of the system that we enjoy now.
I think that's an excellent way of putting it. It has become symbolic, not necessarily because of its, I mean, in certain regards to its content, excuse me, but because of what it represents. And just as an aside, purely by accident, it appeared that we had a version of the Magna Carta in the country at the time war broke out, World War II. It took three documents, and this is just my way to illustrate of how important we perceived it to be. They took was it the St. Albans parchment? I'm not sure which version it was that went to Fort Knox along with an original copy of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence to be safeguarded during the war. So,
can I jump in on something that Russ said, which is maybe it wasn't a critique, but the idea that the king immediately began discarding the rights that were associated with the Magna Carta, just to suggest this, our own Congress did that as well. I mean, in the sense that immediately after ratifying the First Amendment, we had the very first Congress, or one of the very first Congresses, enacting the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were clear, laws that said if you spoke out against the government, you were to be arrested, and if you were not from this country, to be deported. Clear violation of that First Amendment that Madison had helped draft and ratify. So it's often that the government, and especially a king, ignores the dictates of a document because that's the king's prerogative. I think the value of it is creating expectations in society, a recognition that for the king to do that means he is discarding something that he has agreed to do. For Congress to enact this law is disregarding our law, and it creates a norm for the society to kind of live by as well, not just the government. And I think that's part of the value of the Magna Carta as well.
Well, and those values ended up being enshrined in the United States Constitution, and so now they're protected in a way that they could not be disregarded by a single individual or even by Congress. It would require a constitutional amendment, which you probably have some familiarity with how difficult it is to amend the United States Constitution. It would be virtually impossible to eliminate, for example, the right to trial by jury. A constitutional amendment of that nature, it's hard for me to imagine could ever be passed or ratified.
So, Professor Teeter, you were tasked with, I think, really looking into the right to travel as referenced in the Magna Carta and help us understand how that's carried through today. And I gather from some of your comments a minute ago that they're related, particularly with respect to the Alien Sedition Acts, but
A little bit with those, and it's actually, let me begin with an understanding that prior to the Magna Carta, the king could and did bar people from leaving the country and returning to the country. That the King John had refused to allow people to leave who were his other religious or political opponents. He didn't want them to go abroad and then create, you know, an army and rise up against him. So he prevented them from leaving the country. And to leave otherwise, you needed the king's permission. It'd be as if today we needed Governor Herbert's permission to go travel to Nevada or Colorado. That is what the country was like. Part of the basis for that idea was that the king needed to be able to rely on his countrymen if there was a time of war, or to have servants available to him as necessary. And so the Magna Carta was the first document that restricted, or granted really, a right to people to travel out of the country and return to the country. And it was specifically stated in Chapter 42 of the Magna Carta that individuals had the right. There were exceptions, not during time of war, and if you were a criminal, if you were a convict, you were not allowed to travel out of the country, probably good and obvious reasons. But that was the starting point for this first basis that people had a right from leave their country and return to it on the same grounds that they had left, on the same kind of grounds that they were at when they had left. And so that's the starting point for a right to what we now label right to travel. It came to the country and to the colonies, this idea that you could travel to and from England when we had colonies that were in America. And all of actually the English colonies that had this idea of the right to travel to and back from England was available to all colonists. And the Articles of Confederation, our first really founding governmenting document, included a right for individuals to travel in and out of states, and they could move. We could move around the country, the 13 colonies, as people saw fit. Interestingly, that idea didn't carry over into the text of the Constitution. There's no textual right to travel in the Constitution. There had been one in the Articles of Confederation. There isn't one in the Constitution. And justices, when deciding these cases, the Supreme Court has suggested, at least, that the reason for that was that it was just so basic. It was just so accepted, this idea that you could travel around the country, that you didn't need to put it in the text as this firmly rooted notion that you had to say there's a right to travel. But the court has read it in various provisions and has created this right to travel in the due process clauses of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment applies to the states. The Fifth Amendment applies to the federal government. There's a privileges and immunities clause, which is in Article 4 of the Constitution, which says that all citizens of, or people in all states have the privileges and immunities of citizens of other states. And then the court has read into it a right to travel from the privileges or immunities clause of the 14th Amendment, which says that states have to give everyone in their state the same privileges or immunities. And so the court has, from these textual displays, created a right to travel. But one last thing before I turn it over is that this idea of a right to travel isn't what you, I mean, I would love for the government to have to pay for my trip to Hawaii. That's not the right to travel. It's actually, like most rights in our Constitution, a negative right. It's that the government can't restrict our ability to travel. And interestingly enough, that limitation has been read in to not just the ability to go to one state or from another state, but also the right to receive the same benefits in one state that other residents do in that state. So if I were to move to California, I'm entitled to receive the same benefits that California gives its citizens who have been there for 30 years. And so that is what the court has created, this right to travel and the right to be treated equally when you're in a state as the other residents of that state. But while the Magna Carta was about protecting the right to leave the country and return to the country, the court has said there is no right to international travel embedded in our U.S. Constitution. We don't have the right to travel internationally, which is why the government can restrict our abilities to travel to Cuba if it had wanted to for a very long time, or restrict our access to passports. There's a lot of there's much more that the government can do in that regard than it can do domestically.
What about restrictions that existed over time to the rights to travel internally in the country? And I'm just going to display my ignorance. Does, for example, the incarceration in any of the camps or internment camps, does the right to travel come up in those discussions?
It came up a little bit in Korematsu, which was the internment during the World War II of Japanese Americans, in the sense that it was a clear violation of their right to travel. Incarceration is a clear demonstration of the restriction on the right to travel. And to say that we have the right is not to say the government can never infringe on that right. It's just that to do so means the government, in legal terms, has to have a compelling governmental interest, and it has to be necessary to achieve that. But what that means in practical terms is it's really hard for the government to be permitted to restrict our ability to travel internally, domestically. But there are instances when it can, and the court has, incorrectly, in every, I think, historian's view and legal historian's view, incorrectly determined in Korematsu that the government met that burden of having a compelling interest. But it certainly does in its ability to impose requirements on people who have been incarcerated, that they're not allowed to travel outside of the state. States have been permitted to increase penalties for committing a crime and then fleeing across state lines, that you have increased penalties. You could see that as a infringement on the right to travel. Hey, I committed this crime, but I want to be able to travel out of state. I have a right to do it. And the court has said, no, states can restrict our abilities in that way. So there is this historical element, too, that there are, the government is permitted to restrict our ability, but it has to meet a certain level before it's allowed to do so.
That's Professor Michael Teeter, an associate professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour and a discussion today on the legacy of the Magna Carta. That's the 800-year-old legal document from which many ideas such as the right to a trial by jury or the right to travel originate. This is KCBW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, today we're airing a forum recorded recently on the lasting significance of the Magna Carta. A panel of local Utah legal experts have varying views on the significance of the 800-year-old document and how its values still influence judicial practices and law enforcement in the United States today. This is Utah Supreme Court Justice Dino Jimenez, who served as the moderator.
Am I correct in just discerning that over the course of time, it's typically been in times of conflict, external conflict, that the government has abridged the right to travel more than in others?
Certainly in, yes, domestically, well, I would say maybe not domestically, certainly internationally, and in times of conflict, the government imposes much greater restrictions on our ability to travel to particular regions or areas. Internally, there was actually more of a concern originally by the states. The very first cases dealing with the right to travel was when the state governments were trying to tax people from leaving the state. If you left the state, you had to pay a tax. And the court struck down those provisions as violating the right to travel. And prior to that, there were impositions on making it a criminal penalty to bring people into a state who were indigent. During the Great Depression, California tried to exclude people who were indigent from coming into the state and creating a penalty if you paid for somebody to come into the state or encouraged somebody to come into the state who was indigent, and the court in that case struck it down. And so there's this balance of this domestic desire by states to both occasionally exclude people and also to try to prevent people from leaving the state. But internationally, it's about our relationships in times of war and the kind of the conflicts that are going on that where the state and the federal government has tried to restrict our ability to travel.
Russ?
You know, Professor Teeter raises a classic example here of the disconnect between the Magna Carta and the Constitution. And by the way, it took me a long time to get over my habit when I was a student of going and reading what somebody else said about the document and not just go read the document or look at the treaty or whatever the topic of discussion is. It actually pays some dividends to sit and read the Magna Carta. It's not very long. It's like 60 clauses that are all written out, and you can get nice translations of it. It was written in Latin, right?
In Latin.
And
I think you have to read it in the original, though, to really.
Yeah, well, so King John, he spoke French, right? He was a French-speaking guy, because he was connected sort of to the Normans, which came over from France. You remember that? And all the peasants, they spoke English, but they were illiterate, so they write the darn thing down in Latin, partly to satisfy the church, the Holy Roman Church. And there was some of the church stuff tied up in the Magna Carta. So if you go and read it, it's interesting. But there is a right to travel specifically in that Clause 42. There is no such right that's translated into the U.S. Constitution specifically. And you can read the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights if you want to. The American Bar Association has published a little pamphlet. It's not very long. A lot of people talk about the Constitution. Not very many people read it. And it's kind of interesting what doesn't translate back and forth between the Magna Carta and the Constitution, suggesting more in the nature of a cultural transition and a desire to find original sources than an actual lineage that ties together. And part of it is based upon the origin of where the Constitution came from versus the origin of where the Magna Carta came from.
Church Blanche?
The only point that I was going to make is that I think that this right to travel, to the extent that it comes up in litigation often today, relates to these steps that states sometimes try to take to they want to give benefits to their own citizens who have been there for a long time, whether they're welfare benefits or other things, but they want to say, well, you know, we don't want to attract other people to come here, and so there's some period of time within which you have to live here before you're entitled to these benefits, and those are subjected to constitutional scrutiny and are sometimes struck down. Although I will note that the state of Virginia was somehow allowed to require me to pay out-of-state tuition the entire 4 years that I was at the University of Virginia. I'm not sure why that was not unconstitutional. But
it was unconstitutional. You just weren't a lawyer yet.
That's right. Professor, sadly, the statute of limitations is probably run.
Professor Teeter, do you see, does the right come up in any discussion about individuals moving, in the family law context, individuals moving with children or restrictions on the ability of people to relocate with their children?
Well, this it comes in conflict in multiple ways. One is that people have a right to raise their children as they want. That is a fundamental right. Custody of your children is one. So in that family law context, you have several butting up against each other. Yes, it comes up because people want to be able to travel. You know, they've gone through divorce and they want to be able to travel to another state, and the state, one state, has jurisdiction over them. Or it comes up sometimes when people want to be able to move to another state and get married or get divorced, and they can't get divorced within, I don't remember which state, had a year. You had to wait a year before you could get divorced in that state. That is restricting somebody's ability to travel interstate. And the court has just said that those restrictions are typically, there's a good enough reason behind them that the state can restrict our ability to travel in that way. So it comes up, but the court typically in those instances finds that the government has a compelling reason to limit the ability of parents to take their children out of a state where another parent resides, or for a state to restrict the ability to get into a divorce until they've lived there for a year. And states can restrict your ability to vote in that state if you haven't lived there for, 50 days is kind of the max. You have to have lived there for 50 days before you can register and vote in that state. So there are limits that states can place on individuals. In the context of benefits, the court has been much more rigorous in saying you cannot restrict the ability of individuals to get the same benefits of other individuals from that state just because they're new residents. And the court has been pretty scrutinizing of those kind of instances where the states try to do that.
Does this come up at all in the recent discussion about the gay marriage cases and the entitlement to benefits in those particular instances?
It's interesting. I've not seen that as an argument raised in the same-sex marriage cases. You could see that if I can only get married in certain states, then it's restricting my ability to gain access to the marriage. I haven't actually seen it come up, though.
So, Russ, there's a right that's near and dear to the ACLU's heart that you're here to talk about, and that is the concept of habeas corpus. Do we see origin of that term or concept in the Magna Carta?
Okay, habeas corpus. Literally what it means, it's a Latin expression. It means, give me the body. Bring the person here. And it's got a very interesting history, and you might think it's fairly arcane, but we'll bring it around to current relevance here in just a minute. Originally it started out as an idea over on the European continent in the area of Normandy, and it was an idea where, bring this person to me so that I can adjudicate this person's guilt or this person's obligation under law. So it was almost like a subpoena. Bring the person to the court, and I will address that person's interests. And it kind of twisted itself around in between about the 10th century and the 13th century. It twisted itself around where it could become actually a challenge to the king. The challenge was, bring this person forward and justify why you're holding on to this person. Keep in mind that the king had dungeons, and the king had soldiers, and if the king didn't like what you were doing, you'd get thrown in the dungeon and just held there forever with no charges, nobody to speak for you. There was no way to get out until you quit irritating the king for some reason. And you couldn't go to Judge Blanche and say, Judge Blanche, I want an order from you to Governor Herbert releasing this human being. Explain to me why you can hold this person. And you can imagine what a tool of tyranny or oppression this was.
Surely that back then, that's 800 years ago. We're not, there's no current analog.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, Judge Teeter mentioned, and you asked about the internment of the Japanese during World War II. That was an internment of American citizens for the duration of a conflict. Now, originally the idea came up about, I can hold on to this person during a time of armed conflict so they can't go back and help the enemy. So if it's a prisoner of war situation. But the Japanese American citizens were not prisoners of war. They were just rounded up. There were all kinds of fake explanations as to why that could be done. Their property was taken without any compensation. A lot of them were business people, landowners, agricultural people, and they lost everything. If you don't know somebody who's a Japanese American and they don't have part of the story, you're really not very well connected. We had a big camp out in Topaz, which is out near Delta, Utah, where a bunch of folks were held. There were camps in Idaho. There were camps in Wyoming. And the question really was, in a time of war, doesn't the executive have greater power? But you can actually take this back earlier. There is no mention of this word habeas corpus in the Magna Carta. It was just one of those understood things that every once in a while the king had to let somebody go. Curiously, habeas corpus shows up in the American Constitution. And it's in Article 1, Section 9, and it simply says that except in times of war or insurrection, you can't just put people away for no reason at all. It's in the Constitution. It's very simple. So you can read it. You don't have to wait for Rush Limbaugh to tell you what it is. Let me see if I can get it right here. Hang on, I got it. Article 1, Section 9. Here it is. Got it right there. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. So think about the most significant case of rebellion in American history was the Civil War. And the most admired president in American history, Abraham Lincoln, rounded up the legislature from Maryland and a bunch of other folks and just put them away. Because they were on that tipping point right there between the South and the North. Geographically, politically, economically, they were on that tipping point. And Lincoln couldn't abide their neutrality or their actual criticism of the war effort, and he just rounded them up and stuck them away. Curiously, it took Congress a whole year to get around to passing an act that suspended the writ of habeas corpus so he could leave them in there. But, it's a time-honored tradition. But in America, in the 1780s, when the Constitution was being written, it was clearly something that the founding fathers and Madison had in mind that King George was just rounding folks up and putting them away and not telling us why, just so he could get them out of the way.
So if the Magna Carta doesn't specifically mention the term habeas corpus, why do legitimate scholars believe that it's still enshrined somehow in that document?
Okay. Again, you don't have to wait for some constitutional scholar to tell you. You can read the document and you can start teasing out some of these meanings. Near the end of the Magna Carta, some curious concessions were made by King John. By the way, I think there's only one king, right? King John? Because he was so lousy, nobody dared name their son after him again. So there's only one King John. It's not the first or anything, it's just only King John.
It's still a pretty popular name.
Ah, yes, okay, there you go. So near the end of this sucker, King John starts releasing people. We will at once return the son of Llewellyn, all the Welsh hostages, and the charters delivered to us as security for the peace. We're also going to return the sisters and the hostages of Alexander, King of Scotland. And then they go on to say, and this will also apply to all of our fellow countrymen. So the idea of habeas corpus is in there practically and somewhat functionally, but never actually mentioned. Just like the right to travel's in there, but not in the American Constitution. And you have to kind of put things in their contemporary setting in order to understand this.
You know, I'd like to make the observation, since we've all three talked about these different rights, that the real test of the mettle of these rights comes in times of conflict. It's easy in times of peace and prosperity to talk about these rights and have confidence that they're going to mean something. I think we've discussed a little bit about how some of these rights are now enshrined in a way that it's harder to imagine that the rights can be taken away from us. So I talked about the constitutional amendment process, but the right to jury trial is something that comes before the courts and gets debated in the context of enemy combatants, whether or not they have the right to a trial by jury or whether a military commission or something like that is going to be adequate. The right to travel, as Professor Teeter talked about, comes under pressure in the context of World War II and the Korematsu case, the internment case. And then the right to habeas corpus periodically has come under attack when the country is at war, there are security issues or things like this. And you can think of dozens of examples of, you know, some of these rights that we think are very important get stressed and get tested in various ways in the courts when the country is at war, there are other conflicts. And so I think the real test for how strong these values are is how well do they stand up when there's some sort of controversy going on. And I think we've seen them yield from time to time over the decades.
That's a really good point, Judge. The test is when things are not going well. And the right of habeas corpus is right now being tested in Guantanamo. You think that these issues are sort of old-fashioned, maybe, and are just sort of esoteric, and there's no point in even thinking about habeas corpus or the Magna Carta, but there's a guy named Hamdi. He was arrested in Afghanistan. He was turned over to the American forces by the Northern Alliance. Remember that? Remember? 2001, 9/11, about 3 months later, we go into Afghanistan, right? Because Congress had passed
authorization for the use of force.
Authorization for use of military force, thank you. And they said basically to the executive, if you think that somebody is a combatant or they've been involved in Al-Qaeda or 9/11, go get them. And that was the basis for going into Afghanistan. Turned out to be the basis to go into Iraq later. But they're in Afghanistan, and everybody's turning everybody over. It's the best way to get rid of people you don't like on the battlefield. So they turn over Hamdi. Hamdi happens to be a U.S. citizen with Middle Eastern heritage, and he'd gone into Afghanistan about 2 months earlier to do some humanitarian work. He's arrested, he's moved around to different places, he winds up in Guantanamo, and nobody can communicate with him. His father files a writ of habeas corpus and says, I want the son. Tell me why you can hold my son. And the decision of Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, remember Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, required that Hamdi be told what the charges were against him. This is due process. That he be allowed to have a tribunal to determine the legitimacy of those charges, and that he be brought forward so that the court could consider it. And it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and there was kind of an interesting mixed decision on that that Judge Teeter could probably parse for you.
I've been promoted.
Over the course of...
No, you've been demoted.
Professor Teeter, that he could parse for you. It'd take a couple hours probably to work through all the details. But this is currently going on. The new question is, who has the right, even if they're not American citizens? Do they have the right to be told to habeas corpus so they can be released rather than held forever in Guantanamo or some other location?
So, I mean, I think the point of the discussion, then I want to turn over to some questions, is that there may be, again, academic wrangling about the extent to which these rights are referenced in the Magna Carta, the extent to which they represent what we the current contours of these rights. That's fine. But it has come to be symbolic, at least, of a number of these rights, including those that we've been talking about today. And I hope that through this discussion, you can see the incredible relevance that these concepts that were in one form discussed 800 years ago at Runnymede still have everyday meaning and consequences.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a discussion on the legacy of the Magna Carta. This year marks 800 years since the famous document was first penned on parchment paper back in medieval England. The document is credited for establishing several enduring legal values that we appreciate today, including the right to a trial by jury, the right to travel, and the right to habeas corpus. The Magna Carta is respected as a potent and international rallying cry against the arbitrary use of power. Speaking on the panel is Judge James Blanche of the Third District Court, Professor Michael Teeter, Associate Professor of Law at the College of Law at the University of Utah, Russell Ferrix, an ACLU of Utah board member, and Utah Supreme Court Justice Dino Jimenez. Again, this discussion was recorded on April 13th.
Let's take some questions for the panelists at this point in time.
She has a question right back there. I can see it on your face.
Me?
Yeah.
I do have a question.
I know. I can see it on your face. I'm a trial attorney, so I'm highly sensitive to these things.
My name is Madeline. My question is, in 1927, Henry III united the Charter of the Forest with the Magna Carta. The Charter of the Forest, I don't know if... I'm sure you've read about it, which is more of my question. So currently indigenous peoples like First Nation peoples are taking up problems with tar sands like in Alberta, indigenous peoples in rainforests. So I guess my question is, in our constitution currently, is there a lineage from the Charter of the Forest? If not, is there legal standing to put something in there to the Constitution, and what would that look like? Sorry, long question.
Okay, you know what the Charter of the Forest is, right? There was the Magna Carta, sometimes called the Great Charter, Magna Charta, or Carta, as we now call it. There was also a Charter of the Forest at the same time. And in order to work this out, you're going to have to flip the premise. The Charter of the Forest was that the king was extending power into greater and greater areas by saying that the forests were a national or a royal resource that I can control. I control the game, the water, the trees, and I can do whatever I want with them. So as the forests, the control over that became a concern. He had his own court system. He had foresters and sheriffs that were out there. Think Robin Hood, okay? So you're going to have to flip the premise a little bit why don't Native peoples have rights in natural resources? And part of this has to do with the origin of Magna Carta. The king was giving up what the king owned, rights. In America, the people gave up what they owned, rights. They created a government. We, the people, formed the Constitution. You read the Magna Carta, it says, I, the king, we, the king, are going to give you some things that we don't have to, but we're going to do it because we're good people. So the Charter of Forests is probably not your first source of authority on that, but don't overlook it either. It might have some interesting references in there.
Professor Teeter?
I would just say that to your question of whether or not we see any of that lineage in the Constitution, there is in the sense that there is an, you know, we have a Commerce Clause, Article 1, Section 3, or Section 8, Clause 3, gives the federal government the power of Commerce Clause. It also has what's known as the Indian Commerce Clause, which is to say that we treat Native American lands as sovereign. Many Native American tribes have sovereignty over their own lands. And so that, what I think, is part of the lineage, the recognition of this indigenous, the indigenous rights and the government, which the United States government could claim sovereignty over all the land, but instead granted some sovereignty to indigenous tribes, debate whether enough and why they did it. But that's I think, part of the lineage. The other thing I would say is that the king's claim of the right to control this area in some ways actually relates back to the habeas corpus cases that Russ was describing. One of the questions for the court when raising these, hearing these cases from people who are on Guantanamo, the government tried to say, the United States government tried to say, the Constitution doesn't apply in Guantanamo. It doesn't reach to Guantanamo. We're just a small little base on the, you know, on the tip of Cuba. It's Cuba that you're talking about. The Constitution doesn't apply to Cuba. And the court looked to see about that one sliver of land, Guantanamo, who controlled that land. And if the United States government controlled that land, then the Constitution reached that far. The protections reached that far. And one of the most interesting parts of the oral argument before the court that day, one of the attorneys for, I believe it wasn't, I don't think it was in the Hamdi case, but I think it was the Hamban case, but it may have been Hamdi, where the attorney said, look, a stamp with Fidel Castro's picture on it does not get a letter off of the Guantanamo base. You need American mail delivery to do it. And that was the symbolic understanding for the court at that point, that because the United States controlled that land, its protections reached that far. And I think that's, not to say that answers your question, but I think it relates to the same kind of notion that the king's idea of my control extended to the forest, but I'm willing to give you those rights in that area as well.
Church Blatch?
Oh, they have covered everything that I know about this topic and more. So,
do you want to follow up on your question?
No.
Over here?
Yes, my name is Rich. I'm in the communication department. My question, you mentioned that the Magna Carta was ignored almost immediately. My question is, was it ever forgotten for a time? And I put that question in the context that recently I heard some British scholars talking about the Magna Carta, and they contended, it seemed like it was sort of a consensus among the small group that the Magna Carta has been more influential in American political thought. And I'm wondering if there was a time in Britain that just people didn't refer to it at all.
I think there were a number of times where it is disappeared for a particular length of time. Professor Teeter?
I actually, that's outside of my area. I don't know the answer to that question.
Russ?
Sorry, I looked all this stuff up. I was curious myself. So the Magna Carta was one of a multiple iterations of these things. It just happens to be the one that had the best name, so we go back to it all the time. But they sign it in June. In July, John goes to the Pope and says, please invalidate this. In August, the Pope invalidates it. War immediately breaks out. A year later, John dies. And then people start iterating and reiterating. But it did actually kind of go into remission of sorts. And it wasn't until Edward Coke started writing about it in 1500s that it kind of had a revival. He was English, and he was looking at the history of English law. And then the next century, Blackstone starts writing about it. Those are names from jurisprudential history. It was right at that time that the colonies were looking for justification. What was their relationship? Were they free men? Excuse me, ladies. Were they free men? What was their right vis-a-vis King George? And that's why this took on some real fire in the American colonies. Although, curiously, Magna Carta is not mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. It's not there. The reason for that probably was they didn't think they had a problem with a king in America. So we don't need to limit the rights of the king. We don't have a king. We don't have the problems that the Magna Carta was drafted to address. Turns out that the executive does sometimes have some royal prerogatives that we need to constrain.
Now, I looked at this in the narrow question of looking at the right to trial by jury and sort of what happened in the wake of the signing of Magna Carta in 1215. And again, I'm not an historian, but my understanding is that there was a period of benevolent reigns that followed the passage of the Magna Carta, during which time it was, I guess, essentially ignored. And we found ourselves in the period of the Star Chamber. People are familiar with that, where it was essentially the king and some appointed representatives of the king who were making decisions about criminal defendants, criminal cases. And it was not until 1641 that the Star Chamber was abolished. And so that was over 400 years after the Magna Carta. And the language in the act abolishing the Star Chamber, that the king will not pass upon the defendant or condemn him, but by lawful judgment of his peers, I think is every bit as much a source of the right to trial by jury as the language that I quoted earlier from the Magna Carta. And interestingly, even after this, there was a case that involved a jury that was held in contempt and imprisoned because they reached a verdict that was inconsistent with the factual evidence in the eyes of the king that was presented at trial. And that was challenged in court. It was called Bushell's case. And so that was even later that this notion that it would be improper to imprison a jury for reaching a verdict that the king didn't like was established as a principle of law. It's unthinkable now that you'd punish jurors for the decision that they reached, but these were things that came along long after the Magna Carta. And so it's, I think, useful primarily, as we talked about before, as a document that refers to concepts and principles that have become very important to us now. And it has some historical relevance in that regard, but it does appear that there was a period of stagnation between its original signing and the rights that we enjoy now.
Far from punishing jurors, any comment by a judge on a jury's verdict is enough to get you in front of the Judicial Conduct Commission or worse.
And that's something we have to think about all the time. I make it a practice after every jury trial to go back and talk to the jurors about the experience, and they take it very seriously. They take it much more seriously than you might think. Sometimes people are cynical about juries. Even in a small case, a misdemeanor case, the jurors take their responsibilities very seriously. They ask me all the time, well, did we get it right? They want to know that. Judges are not allowed to comment on the evidence, so you're not allowed to tell the jury whether they got it right or wrong. Hopefully I'm not going too far out on a limb to tell jurors, you know, the decision was yours to make, and no one can criticize it one way or the other. But jurors are not allowed to, or judges are not allowed to comment on the evidence. That's up to the jury.
I guess plenty of people can criticize it. It just can't be us. So. Other questions? Yes.
Tim Chambliss. I teach here in Hinckley Institute, Political Science Department. April 28th, 2004, I was at the U.S. Supreme Court in a very crowded courtroom. I heard the oral argument in Hamdi versus Rumsfeld. Defense attorney had reserved the last 5 minutes. When he had the last 5 minutes, I timed to see how long he would speak. He looked directly at Justice Scalia. I could look right over his shoulder, right at Scalia. He gazed at Scalia, and he spoke expecting to be interrupted at any time. And he went 2 minutes and 15 seconds with no interruption from any of the justices. And he finished his argument specifying exactly habeas corpus as you've stated it. And then with 2 minutes and 45 seconds remaining, he said, thank you. Sat down, and he won the case 8-1. By the way, Russ, he's a Saudi citizen, dual citizenship, Saudi.
Yeah, he had dual citizenship. If you get a chance, read Justice Scalia's concurring opinion in Hamdi. That is a fascinating effort to reach back to the Magna Carta and other similar charters and try to glean some original intent. Scalia's an original intent guy. And it's a fascinating, you can read it, even if you're not a lawyer, you will understand it. It's very historically couched in exactly
and
those terms.
And I can tell you, I understand high drama. In that room, it was jam-packed. You see the perspiration rising up through the room. I've seen 17 hours of oral argument. That case is the one that's always going to be memorable with me because it was high drama. A movie should be made out of that scene because the arguments were so clear going back 800 years and so relevant to our lives today.
Yep. Are you telling me we're out of time? So thank you, everybody, for the ability to be here to talk to you all about the Magna Carta and celebrating its 800th anniversary this June. And thank you to the panelists.
Well, thank you today to Judge James Blanch, Professor Michael Teeter, Russell Ferrix, Justice Dino Jimenez, and the Hinckley Institute of Politics. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.